When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 138. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I'm very excited to be joined by a man who's been described in many different ways by many different people over the years. But for the purpose of this introduction, I will say the environmentalist George Monbiot. George, thank you very much for joining me. And out of interest, what would you describe yourself as?
Well, I guess environmental campaigner and journalist. It's probably the politest thing I ever get called.
I want to start by just getting to know you a bit. Where did you grow up and what kind of childhood did you have?
So I was brought up in South Oxfordshire in a rural area, small village, on the edge of a common, which was a really beautiful place, actually. It was a rewilded golf course. I guess about 30 years before I was born, it was gradually these successional processes were happening, and you could see them carrying on throughout my childhood. So you could see the blackthorn scrub moving over the fairways and all the warblers and stuff moving into it. You saw the trees growing in the rough, the development of heather, of heath, dry heath and gorse. Lizards and stuff started proliferating in that, and it was just amazing to follow those processes. And I was always fascinated by wildlife, by ecology, but also by archaeology, and there was a lot of that there too. We had these Neolithic flint pits where they were mines, so it was the old mines in the Neolithic, and we used to play circuses and stuff in them. But we were also, I was really fascinated by the archaeology, and we found flint knives and scrapers and arrowheads and stuff. And there was an old sarsen stone in the woods, which had acquired a sort of local legends around it. You know, if you sort of spat into the hole in the top, you'd make any wish you wanted. And so with my friends, it was basically a more or less entirely outdoor life. Every moment we could be outdoors, we were, and we had our gangs, and we would try to capture each other's camps, and sometimes it got a bit violent, and we would try to stake out territory and all this stuff. And it was lovely, you know, all that, just having that outdoor life. And you know, it saddens me that so many kids don't have that, didn't have it then, and fewer probably have it today.
So that's where your interest in the natural world came from then, really, very early on in your life.
It was that, and my grandma, who she sort of lived a life like a sort of female version of Last of the Summer Wine. All these crazy old ladies who I'd go and stay with her often a couple of weeks at a time in the holidays. And and we would, she taught me to fish, she taught me to fly, tie my own flies, she taught me to identify plants and birds and things. But we would also visit all these crazy old ladies on their small holdings or living in their narrow boats. There was one we used to visit who used to wear her wellies in the kitchen. She had, like, the garden was full of pigs and geese and stuff, and the kitchen was literally 2 inches deep in mud, and would always go away with like a couple of hen's eggs or even a goose egg sometimes. And it was really amazing, and I loved those old ladies. They were just very special in some ways. They were like almost my favorite characters of all the people I ever met in my childhood.
And you went on to study zoology at Oxford. What was that experience like?
So it was disappointing in a way, in that it had almost no ecology. Well, it had ecology as a scientific discipline in it, which is great, but almost no practical ecology, almost no conservation, almost no environmental aspects at all. In fact, we begged the lecturers to give us some environmental lectures, and we finally got one. And this guy, you know, he was a great ecologist, but he just was so politically naive. He said, the problem is all these peasants moving into the Amazon, I would machine gun them. And it was like, you know, and even as stupid students, we were like, what? You know, what's that? Yeah. And it was a lesson for me, because, you know, if I were to stand back from that and say, what should I have done? It would not have been to go to Oxford to study zoology. It would have been to go for a sort of less prestigious university to study ecology and fieldwork, for instance, because that's where my real passion was. But everyone was saying, that's where you need to go. You know, that's the place to go. And it was a lesson that, you know, you've got to make your own decisions and not be pushed into things which sound like a great thing to do, but actually don't necessarily work well. So it was, you know, I mean, I liked a lot of the aspects of the work on the course, but it was just left me with this feeling that we're not even scratching the surface here. You know, for a start, it was super specialized. And so you end up not knowing very much about the world as a whole. But it was so concentrated on the most rarefied academic aspects of zoology. And there was so little on what is actually going on in the world today. And these amazing systems we're studying, they are disappearing. So why aren't we studying that? Why aren't we talking about it? And so even at that stage, I felt like I was banging my head against a wall.
Hmm. And you did work on a few farms, though, during your university holidays. What was that like?
Starting in my gap year, when I worked for 3 months on a pig farm, and that covered the intense freeze of 81-82. That was really something, because all the automatic feeding system froze up, all the pipes froze. So for 2 weeks, we just had to run with buckets. We'd arrive at 7 in the morning and you'd have two-gallon buckets. Either they'd both be this sort of liquid feed, which is basically skim milk and bran and stuff, or water. And you would just start running, and you'd run for the best part of 12 hours just with buckets of stuff. And I would literally fall asleep in the shower, you know, night after night, fall asleep in the shower. I was very fit. But
I can't understand why you didn't go for a career in farming after that, George.
Well, you know, I mean, there were aspects of it I really loved. You know, I love the physical work. I love the sort of camaraderie. I mean, there was some, you know, they were a very funny bunch of people on the farm. But, you know, it's like there was, unless, you know, you have the means to own a farm, it's just like you're always basically going to be at someone else's beck and call. You know, that for me was a fundamental. And so I actually did look in at one stage. I looked into fish farming, thought, is that the way forward? Because I wouldn't need to own the land. And so now environmentally, this is just a complete catastrophe. So I don't want to do that. I also worked on a mixed farm, but I also did a project for Thames Valley farmers on whether it was ecologically acceptable to burn stubble. And had an amazing summer working with two other sort of not very qualified scientists. None of us really, I mean, we were all right. It was reasonable experimental design. It wasn't great. Seeing whether you could burn stubble without causing environmental problems. It was pretty inconclusive, but broadly speaking, you couldn't, you know, so it was part of the evidence base. It became part of the evidence base, which led to the end of stubble burning, which I think was a very good thing.
Okay, so when did you start to realise or believe that things weren't right with the wider environment? Was that a gradual realisation, or was there some catalyst moment?
It was pretty early on. I mean, I was obsessed from my first memory, you know, with the natural world. It was just like I just thought it was amazing. You know, I loved animals, I loved plants, I loved every single thing that lived. Was just fascinating to me, I gradually, you know, through my childhood became aware that things weren't right, that, you know, everything I loved was in danger, and a lot of it was actually disappearing, and disappearing very fast. And I had my first environmental confrontation when I was 8 years old, And there was this bloke on the common who was, he had firewood rights on the common, and he was cutting down or intending to cut down this old hollow cherry tree, which had a woodpecker's nest inside, a green woodpecker's nest. And I've been watching over the course of several days the woodpeckers, because the baby woodpeckers were fledging, and this bloke turns up with his chainsaw. And I sort of knew him a little bit, not very well, but I basically said, just, you know, please don't cut down this tree. You know, there's all these other trees. Why don't you take them? He said, oh, I've got my right. I can cut this down. And so I ended up hanging on to the tree. But I was quite an obedient boy, and I went home for lunch, because that was the one rule. The one rule is you can play on the common all day long, but you must come home for lunch, you know. And it was just implanted in my mind, whatever happens, I must come. And of course you had to, because otherwise your parents would wonder what had happened to you and all the rest. So I went home for lunch and came back, and, well, you can guess the result. And so, I learned a couple of important lessons. Don't go home for lunch. And don't do it by yourself.
You started off making environmental programs for the BBC. Perhaps you could just tell us a bit about those early days there, and when you moved to the World Service. I mean, I know that's when your life really began to change. You were going all around the world. I know you wrote about your time in Indonesia in your first book, Poisoned Arrows.
All I wanted to do was to make investigative environmental programs. That was the only thing I wanted to do. And they didn't exist at that time. There was no such job. So in my sort of the second half of my time at university, about a year and a half, I spent just bombarding the BBC's Natural History Unit with proposals for programs. And, yeah, I could do this for you, I could do that for you, and all the rest of it. And eventually I got a phone call in the middle of my finals. I don't know if I'm allowed to say this on your podcast, so forgive me. Where the head of the unit, the exact words were, "You're so fucking persistent, you've got the job." and so it was a bit of a baptism of fire, because, you know, I didn't know my ass from my elbow. You know, I just sort of plunged straight in there. But and so I spent a few weeks making wildlife programs, sort of soft focus stuff, for radio. This was, and then I was gradually let loose to start investigating environmental destruction and malfeasance, and it was amazing, because at the time the BBC was a very bold organization, so it would put its resources, if it thought you had a good story, it would put serious resources into finding out what was happening. And we cracked some massive stories. I mean, one where there was this bulk carrier, this massive ship, which appeared to have been deliberately scuppered off these rocks off the southwest of Ireland, and was pumping bunker oil over the beaches with devastating impacts and stuff. And, you know, we were able to show that there was pretty conclusive evidence that this was an insurance job. And and then we ended up sort of following the trails. I mean, it was a really, it was a powerful piece of program making. And then we had another one where we had the head of customs in Abidjan offering to sell us illegally chimpanzees for experiments and stuff, you know. So you know, we cracked some big stories, and some of them made the news worldwide, you know. And I thought, this is me, this is my job, this is my life now, I'm going to carry on doing this. And then January 1987, Mrs. Thatcher launched her coup against the BBC, which had really upset her by some of its investigative programs, like Maggie's Militant Tendency and Secret Society and stuff. And she forced the Director General to resign, and made all these massive changes. And my boss came in the day after he resigned and said, "That's it." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "No more investigative programs. We've had it from the top." And I said, what do you mean? That's journalism, investigative programs, that's journalism. Yeah. You can't not do investigation. He said, "Sorry, out of my hands, can't do it." So I was just poleaxed by that. I couldn't believe it. And, you know, the BBC's never recovered. But at the time I was working on this really massive story, which had never been covered properly by anyone, which was the transmigration program in Indonesia, funded by the World Bank, by the UK government, by the US government, were operating through this brutal dictatorship, the Suharto dictatorship, moving hundreds of thousands of people out from Java and Bali to the outer islands. with all sorts of ethnic cleansing and genocide and stuff going on alongside it, and basically to turn it into a great big security state with the same kind of government and culture everywhere. And it was devastating for, you know, local people, for the trans migrants, for local ecosystems, you know, because it was had palm oil and mining and all this stuff at its heart. So, and this was what I was intending to do with the BBC. But when it became obvious that I had no future at the BBC, because that's, you know, I just wanted to do investigative programs, I took it to some publishers instead, to Penguin, and said, look, I'm mad enough to do this. Are you mad enough to fund me? And they were. They were mad enough to fund me. So then I phoned up my best friend, Adrian Arbib, who's a photographer, and said, look, I've got this contract to go to Indonesia, particularly to West Papua, this occupied territory, which was the epicenter of where it was all happening. It's unbelievably dangerous. And he said, yes. I said, I haven't asked you a question yet. He said, the answer is yes. because, you know, we were both, you know, we were, what were we at the time? 24. And, you know, you're mad at that age. I mean, some people say I still am, but you know, you, this is why wars get fought. You really think you're invulnerable. You know, you think you could just get away with anything. And in a way, that belief allows you to, you know, you sort of can, because you sort of just push your way through. And so I then worked briefly at the World Service, basically quite cynically, really, just to learn Indonesian, to get more of a handle on the world, to earn a bit of money to fund the trip. You know, so I was sort of using the BBC, but I was pretty cynical by then. You know, I was like, sod the BBC was basically my, well, not the BBC, but, you know, sod the way it was going, you know, because so. And so then we set off. So October 87 to Indonesia. And the first thing we tried to do was to get a permit to go to West Papua, which was this occupied territory, still is an occupied territory, where all this, we'd heard all these rumors of horrendous stuff going on there. And you weren't allowed in. There was just no way, you know, and we were banging our heads against the wall. I spent 2 weeks going with Adrian to the police headquarters, trying to persuade someone, anyone, to give us this travel permit called a Surat Jalan. Go. Out any success. And then one day I went down the corridor down this corridor to get a drink of water. And I saw this open door which said head of immigration police on the door. And so I thought, I'm going to go in and persuade this guy. And you know, we'll make friends with him. That's what I'm going to do, persuade him. So I knock on the door and there's no answer. So I push the door a bit further open and the office is empty. But on this his desk is his pad of headed notepaper and a stamp. So I thought, okay, very sorted. So we forged ourselves this permit, and it got us in there and got us into and out of a phenomenal amount of trouble. You know, we once got caught by soldiers at a roadblock who didn't believe this letter. They just didn't believe that we could possibly have got this letter. So they held us for 3 days while they tried to make radio contact with Jakarta. And had they made contact, they would have shot us. There's no question in my mind. My hair was coming out in clumps. But they failed. They couldn't get a link. So they let us go again. And then we had to walk for 4 weeks over the mountains and down into the southern swamps to get to where we wanted to go. We got completely lost in the rainforest. And for 3 or 4 days, had no food at all. Except rats, snakes, insects, anything we could grab to eat. And that was it. Got all sorts of interesting diseases, nearly got stung to death by hornets, got swept away down a river. I mean, it is pretty miraculous we ever came out, but we got the story. It was horrendous. I told it as a sort of travelogue, but, you know, explaining the story at the same time. So that was my first book, Poisoned Arrows. And then on the back of that, I got an advance to go to the Amazon. There's similar sort of investigations. I lived there for a couple of years, got into massive trouble also. In fact, my death was reported in a Brazilian newspaper.
Yes, I was going to ask you, what was it like reading about your
death? It was very nearly reported in The Guardian. At that time, I had no contact with I'd never done anything with The Guardian, but it was this bizarre thing that I'd been working in the northeast of Brazil, in the state of Maranhão, this land dispute, working with these peasants whose land was being seized by a rancher with the full backing of the state, the police, the judiciary, everyone behind this rancher and these peasants, you know, who were being massacred, literally massacred, yeah. You know, they were being killed, being tortured, having their houses burnt down. You know, it was really horrendous. And I got caught by the police and I nearly got shot and I got beaten up and all sorts of stuff happened. And anyway, this local paper, erroneously as it turned out, said I'd been garrotted behind the police station and my body had been found. I didn't know this. I was just told by, there were some human rights lawyers working with the local priests who were trying to help the peasants, who said, just get out now. They're going to come after you. They're going to kill you tonight if you don't leave the state. So I got on the night bus and I went. And 2 days later, I pitch up in Manaus in the middle of the Amazon where I was living. A couple of days after that, I go in to meet my contact, who is working for a human rights organization, who had put me onto that story in the first place, basically to debrief. I go into the office and he was on the phone and he said, hold on. I'm just talking to this person. He's chatting away. Yeah. Oh, actually, he says to the person on the phone, someone's just come in who can help you with that. So he passes me over and he says, it's Jan Rocha from The Guardian. I'd never met her. I'd subsequently did, but and she said, "Oh, I hear you just gone back from Maranhão." And I said, "Yeah, I have. Yes." She said, "No, I'm following up this story that's in the papers about this British journalist who's been killed there." And I said, "Oh no!" I said, "God, that's terrible." And she said, "Yeah, no, it was he was in the Bacabal area." I said, "That's amazing. That's just where I was. I never knew there was another British journalist there. Oh, jeez, God, I was nearly killed myself, but you know, I got away. It was all right." And she said, "Well, it's a really bad situation. This guy, he got garrotted by the police. His body was found behind the police station." So, I'm not surprised. I said, "Those police, they're monsters. It's terrible." I said, "So who was this guy?" He said, "Well, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name. It's George Monbiot or Monbiot. I don't know. I said, "Ah, right. I think that story might not be entirely accurate."
I mean, it's fair to say that you lived pretty dangerously back then and had several frightening experiences, been beaten up by gunmen in Brazil and nearly dying of cerebral malaria in northern Kenya. What kind of effect did those kind of experiences have on you? Did they change the way you looked at the world, do you think?
Yeah, it was my political education, I guess. You know, I was, you know, naive. I was in my 20s. I, you know, knew sod all about the world, really. And it was a steep learning curve. You know, I learned about man's inhumanity to man, really. I learned about, you know, what we do to each other and to the living world, and the extent of it, which was mind-blowing. I mean, just off the scale, the stuff I was seeing and experiencing. And it was very traumatic at times. But it was also like, you know, all the time while I was doing it and, you know, having some very close shaves. But even so, it was like I was just constantly going through my mind, this is your real education. You know, this, you know, what I learned at university, what I learned at school, was just preparation for the real education. Like, this is my PhD, you know, this is the real sort of university of life. And so when I came back, I felt I came back with an understanding of the world that I just didn't have before.
When you returned to Britain, you started getting involved with various direct action movements over here. How did that come about to start with?
So it was some friends of mine who said to me, "Look, this stuff you've been doing abroad, there's something similar happening here." And that's the Rhodes Programme, where the government, this was 1993, the John Major's government is basically joining up all the dots between the sites of special scientific interest and the scheduled ancient monuments and building motorways through them. That was a plan. And it was unbelievable, the scale of it. And it's like, it's going to deprive local people of their land. It's going to destroy all these beautiful places. And it's going to put loads more cars on the road and trash the planet at the same time. So what are we going to do about it? Well, already by then, this direct action movement had started up. Fighting over Oxley's Wood in London, over Twyford Down near Winchester. And several of my friends said, look, just come to Twyford and you'll see, you'll understand. Because I've been a bit resistant to it. I was thinking, well, look, by comparison to what I've been seeing, what is this, you know? And they took me down to Twyford Down to this big protest camp down there. And I was thinking, actually, this is exactly what I was seeing. This is people losing their land, losing their connection, for the sake of big business capital. The construction company was a bit like the big landlord, and here were these local people just deeply grieved by what was happening to these beautiful places. So I threw myself into that and became very active in it, particularly at a site just outside Bath, Salisbury Hill, this beautiful hill with an Iron Age hill fort on top and really amazing habitats all around the side. And they were carving this massive road through it, which was going to be part of a sort of motorway by stealth that they were intending to build from the M4 to Southampton. Yeah. And this was the way they were doing a lot of it. They were building all these apparent bypasses, but they just all happened to join up into a Great Big Motorway. So they didn't have to get permission, planning permission for a motorway, just for local bypasses. And because people would never have accepted those new motorways. And it was very devious. And so I joined this sort of wild and woolly camp of people living in the trees. And we spent months just trying to hold off the bulldozers and, and several of us got pretty severely beaten up. I had my, I was thrown onto a pile of, fencing materials with spikes on the top by two security guards. And, in fact, very nearly killed because one of the spikes went just past my neck, but one went through the top of my foot, top of my boot. And when I tried to stand up, I found I was impaled on it, and I sort of pulled my foot off it with a great sort of noise, and all this blood started spurting out the top of my boot, and it turned out that the middle bone was smashed, quite spectacularly smashed, and so I had to have it all operated on and plaster and stuff. You know, no thought of anyone being prosecuted for it. You know, they were just beating us up with impunity, but. Carried on, did that for quite a while, and then off the back of that, founded an organization called The Land Is Ours to try to massively improve public access both to the land itself and to decision-making over the land. Because it seemed to me, whether you're in Brazil or in Britain, that it's profoundly wrong that a tiny number of people should be able to make the majority of decisions over our most fundamental resource.
Well, we're recording this in the midst of the COVID-19 crisis. And you wrote recently in The Guardian about how that could be a catalyst for land use reform here in the UK, which is why I specifically got in touch with you about an interview. But can you explain this thought process to our listeners, please?
Mm-hmm. So what I'm calling for, and others as well, is for a very similar code of access to in the rest of the UK to the one that we've got in Scotland, and so there's this Scottish Outdoor Access Code, which basically says you can walk anywhere except in people's gardens, standing crops, around the curtilage of schools, but pretty well everywhere else is access land. And this was extremely controversial before it was introduced. And everyone said it's going to end in total disaster. There'll be massive conflicts and problems and stuff. But actually, it's worked out pretty well. And the great majority of the problems which people anticipated have not materialised.
Yeah, well, I mean, I know a lot of farmers up in Scotland. In fact, I've got family there who farm. And they would say that the downside of that increased access has been trampled crops, trampled habitat, livestock attacks by loose dogs, fly tipping, even in some cases violent crime. Increased access, that is wonderful in theory, isn't it? But isn't it true that this is why we can't have nice things? A minority spoil it for us all.
I mean, look, there's always going to be some plonkers around. You know, that is clear. And you know, we have to legislate against plonkers. That is what the law is for, basically. And you know, we do that in our cities. We say, you know, there's free access to the pavements, there's free access to the streets. You're not allowed to speed. You're not allowed to spray graffiti on people's walls. You're not allowed to let your dog shit on the pavement. You know, there are rules. Not everyone abides by those rules, but we don't close the streets and close the pavements because of the few plonkers who spoil it for other people. We try instead to make sure that those plonkers are restrained as much as they can be. And the same applies to access and it to the countryside. And, you know, it's true. Mm-hmm. There are people who will abuse that. But there's also, there's a flip side of that, which is that there are eyes and ears in the countryside. If there are people there, I mean, you know, if you're intent on rural crime, and you're in a place where no one ever walks, you've got a free hand. If you're in a place where you don't know if someone's going to be coming around the corner the next minute, you might be much less confident about carrying out that crime. And, you know, despite my views on sheep, several times I've rescued sheep when I've been on my rambles who got their heads stuck in a fence or stuck in brambles and stuff like that. And, you know, there's a couple of times I've alerted farmers to the fact that their stock are escaping through a gate and things like this. You know, I think the majority of people are good walkers. You know, that of course there are idiots. Of course there are idiots. But, you know, if we live our lives because of the way a few idiots behave, then we all lose our freedoms that way.
Okay. So rewilding. I cannot possibly speak to George Monbiot without mentioning the word rewilding. It is a word that provokes very strong reactions, especially in the farming community. What are your beliefs around rewilding to start with, and how would you like to see it realistically implemented?
So rewilding is the mass restoration of ecosystems, allowing natural processes to reassert themselves, reintroducing missing species, particularly the keystone species, the animals which drive natural processes, and allowing to the greatest extent possible nature to be self-determined. And to me, it goes hand in hand with repeopling the land, as we're talking about, with public access, and with a more democratic discussion of and control over how land is used. And for me, where the most obvious places for rewilding are places where farm productivity is very low. And in the UK, that primarily means the uplands, where in many places you've got one sheep per hectare, one sheep per 2 hectares, one sheep per 5 hectares in some places, very low productivity, sustained only with public subsidies. So my feeling is, well, the public should have a say in how those subsidies are spent. I'm not sure that many people would want so much land to be basically removed from wild nature for so much public money and with so little productivity. So, you know, that's what I'd like to change. We're living through at the moment the sixth great extinction. We're living through this existential crisis for us and for a huge number of other species in the world. And the UK is no exception to that. Out of, 216 nations, we're 189th in terms of the intactness of our natural ecosystems. And I feel we have a moral duty to try to reverse that, to try to restore some of the places that have been so badly damaged, to bring back functioning and rich living systems for the benefit of human beings as well as for the benefit of the rest of the living world.
Do you think there are opportunities for farmers with rewilding, if we can embrace it, if we can get past the word itself? I think we can all agree that the farming industry in the UK isn't exactly thriving at the moment. Could this help us, do you think?
I think it could. I mean, the problem is people seeing past it, like you say. But actually, you know, my experience, farmers are highly resilient, highly adaptable, you know, very responsive to market signals. Mm-hmm. And if the public money is going, is saying do something else, then farmers will do something else. And actually, you know, this is, there's a possibility of A, something which the public would be very glad to fund, and B, something which could, under the right circumstances, become self-sustaining to the extent that extensive farming in the uplands is not. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a loss-making enterprise, as we know, and it requires constant injections of public money to keep it going. So I think there are opportunities here. And I think, you know, those opportunities should be explored. You know, especially after Brexit, if Brexit happens now, I think we should assume for the time being that it is going to happen. It won't be possible for politicians anymore to say, oh, this farm subsidy business is out of our hands. Mm-hmm. You know, it's Europe. It's their fault, which is basically what they've been saying all the time, even while in some ways the UK government was making it worse through its lobbying activities within Brussels. And now, you know, they have to take ownership of those policies and those subsidies. And people will say, well, you know, why are we spending £3 billion a year? You know, are we getting what we want from this money? And if you can show to people, actually, what we're getting is a massive ecological restoration and amazing wildlife and incredible habitats and wonderful experiences and public access and the rest of it coming back, then, you know, my guess is that people will be much more prepared to carry on spending that money. Mm. You know, we're all taxpayers here. We all have a stake in this game. You know, we have a financial stake. We also, I feel, have a democratic stake because we're all members of this nation. And yet, in terms, in physical terms, but also in democratic terms, we are excluded from most of the land. We're kind of trespassers in our own nation. And I want to see that change. Mm.
Okay. Now, in August last year, you wrote an article entitled The Spectre at the Feast, where you said that the livestock industry is trashing the living world and free-range pasture-fed meat is the worst offender. Do you really believe that's true? I mean, I find that claim to be quite astonishing. I mean, I guess you must believe it's true, otherwise you wouldn't have wrote it. But perhaps you could just clarify that.
Yeah, so I know this is something people find very hard to swallow, and I understand that because, you know, all the story is about the horrors of intensive livestock farming, and yeah, you know, that is also, it can be pretty horrific. But the problem with extensive farming is that by definition, it occupies a larger area of land for the amount of food that's produced. Mm-hmm. That's the very definition of extensive versus intensive farming. Yep. And that land area can be very large indeed. So, you know, if you look at sheep production in the UK, upland sheep probably occupy around 4 million hectares. Uh-huh. There's no definitive figures on it, but that's my best estimate of the land it occupies, which is a little less than the arable area, not much less. But it only produces, in terms of calories, 1.2% of our food. Uh-huh. It's over twice the area of the entire urban area. And I just feel that is a fantastically profligate use of land. That is land which could be our great wildlife habitats, our great refuges for wildlife, which has been very largely wiped out in this country. You know, we have incredibly thin and shallow food webs. We've lost all our top predators. Yeah. We've lost most of our large herbivores. We've lost a huge range of wildlife, of diversity and of abundance. And the places you would look to for that wildlife to be would be in the less fertile uplands. That's the obvious place where you'd have your wildlife refuges. But it's because of sheep farming that isn't happening. That there's something else happening there instead, which is sheep. And the reason I got into rewilding was that I lived in mid Wales for 5 years. I lived between Snowdonia on one side and the Cambrian Mountains on the other, in the town of Chantleth. Mm-hmm. And when I first got there, I was really excited about being there. I thought, here is this amazing wild land all around me. And you could walk in any direction, mm-hmm. just set off straight from the front door. And within a couple of minutes, you were in the countryside and you could just walk all day. And most days, literally not see a human being. I had two friends who walked for 6 days across the Cambrian Mountains and didn't see one other person. Mm-hmm. It was quite unbelievable. But as my walks continued, that excitement gave way to puzzlement, and the puzzlement gave way to disappointment, and so the disappointment gave way to despair, because I was hardly seeing any wildlife either. Now, I'm a very good wildlife spotter. I'm an observant person. I've been doing it since I was a very small child. I know what I'm looking for. I know how to look. And I was absolutely flabbergasted by how little there was. You walk all day, see a couple of crows and a pipit, a few Canada geese on a lake, perhaps. You could get down on your hands and knees in the middle of summer and push through the sward. There'd be hardly any insects. There were almost no trees above around 200 meters. Apart from conifers, obviously Sitka spruce, but, you know, no native trees. And then where there were woodlands, they were almost completely grazed out. There was no understory. And the trees were generally about 100 years old, and there were no younger ones because all the seedlings had been eaten. And you could literally see those old woods dying on their feet, where at the edges of the wood, the old trees were falling over and nothing was replacing them. Mm-hmm. And there was one wood in particular I knew, got to know, where there was, you know, literally no understory at all. It was just sheep shit and moss and turned over leaves. And then as you went out through the wood, you'd see these dead trees fallen over. And then a little bit beyond them, you would see these mossy mounds where dead trees had fallen over a few years before and had been covered by moss. And then you'd see those mounds getting smaller and smaller as you went away from the wood. And then you were in this just sphagnum and millennia beyond that. And it was profoundly depressing. You could literally see those ecosystems dying, and they were being killed by sheep because tree seedlings are highly nutritious. Sheep seek them out, browse them preferentially, and then they prevent the forest from regenerating. They prevent the young trees from growing, and gradually they clear them. They clear the woods. And I was just thinking, okay, so I'm not seeing people here, which is itself a sad thing, but I'm also not seeing wildlife. And how did we engineer this? How did this come about? And said, well, this is sheep grazing. That's what's doing it. And then I thought, wait a minute, if that's happening here, that's what I've been seeing across the rest of the UK. The uplands in the rest of the UK, including most of our national parks, the same thing is happening. This is a huge area of land, including all the major areas that we would expect natural processes to be flourishing. Instead, this is happening. And I began to realize that what I was looking at was an ecological disaster zone.
But George, people listening to this, and you say that you recognize that situation all across the UK, farmers just, that's just not what they recognize. That isn't the landscape they see on their farms. What they see is quite a flourishing ecosystem. You know, how do you square what you're seeing with what they're saying? And how do you respond to that?
Mm. We all see the same thing differently, don't we? You know, no two people's perceptions are the same because they're coloured by our own life experience. They're coloured by what we're in particular looking for. Sure. So as an ecologist walking across a piece of land, I might see that land very differently to how a farmer would see it walking across the same land. As someone who turns up for the first time to a piece of land, I would see it differently to someone who's just become used to it, who's become accustomed to how it is. And so something which for me is profoundly shocking isn't shocking at all for someone who lives there, because that's just a land that surrounds them. And I hear these extraordinary things said about a piece of land I'm familiar with. Oh, it's this rich ecosystem, it's this thriving ecosystem. So they, okay, well, so where are the trees? Where are the predators? Where are the birds? Where are the insects? Where's the floral diversity? Where is it? I'm not seeing any of that here. It just does not exist. And it's particularly stark where you can see the contrast. So, for instance, one place close to where I used to live, there was a fence with a verge of about 2 meters wide with sheep pasture on the other side of the fence. And all along that verge was this rich habitat with young trees growing up, with a huge range of flowering plants, with loads of insects, with birds moving in and out of it. On the other side, it was like a bowling green with contours. It was just flat grass, well, just very low grass and a few rocks sticking out of it and sheep. And the ecological contrast was mind-blowing. And it was like, okay, so what the highways agency has done here, or the highways authority has done, by fencing off or insisting that the farmer fences off the land and keeps the sheep off the verge, is to give us a glimpse of what this could be like, if it weren't for the sheep on the other side of the fence. And so when you see those contrasts, and there's quite a few in Wales where places have been fenced off and for some reason or another, there's no grazing on one side of the fence, but there is on the other, mm-hmm. where you just have this really stark contrast. It's like a sort of, here's one I made earlier, you know, it's like the before and after picture. And yeah. and as an ecologist, you are just overwhelmed by the sensation of what you see on both sides of those fences. Sometimes it's like a line drawn across the landscape and it's two different worlds on either side of it.
Mm. Now farmers and me amongst them would argue that we have the perfect conditions in this country to produce food with the right climate, the right infrastructure, the right expertise. If we're to take good fertile land out of production for rewilding in this country, aren't we just exporting our environmental conscience somewhere else?
Well, I'm definitely not for taking good fertile land out of production. Where I'm focusing on is the places where the soil is thin and poor and the weather is harsh, and where you've got very low productivity. And, you know, we have very large areas like that in our uplands. In the lowlands, I'd like to see very limited rewilding, principally around the river corridors. So in other words, buffer zones around the rivers. And there's lots of good reasons for that. You know, keep pollution out of the rivers, keep silt out of the rivers. You create fantastic corridors for wildlife to move up and down. But apart from that, I'm not looking at extensive rewilding in the lowlands because of exactly what you're talking about. I don't want to see a major reduction in food production. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if we wanted to become more self-sufficient in food, and we wanted to become less reliant on imports of all kinds, imports of food, but also of farm chemicals and the rest of it, then switching towards a plant-based diet is by far and away the best way of doing that. And that would allow loads of land to be released from farming, which currently used exclusively for animals, which could then be rewilded. So, you know, rather than importing our wildlife adventures as well, with everyone going off to Kenya or something to see amazing wildlife, you know, we could become much more self-sufficient in ecotourism as well as in food.
Yeah, well, we might have to get used to that anyway.
Yeah, quite.
You often use very emotive terms in your writing and your Guardian articles and your books, such as sheep wrecked, apocalypse cow. Isn't that counterproductive? As it's obviously going to get our backs up as a farming industry. And whether you like it or not, we are the ones who control the vast majority of the land in this country. Wouldn't it be better to try to work with us rather than against
us?
Well,
look, there's a huge spectrum of people involved in this. And almost everybody is saying we're working with farmers, you know, whether it's the RSPB or the National Trust or the Wildlife Trust, you know, all the big organizations, most of the small organizations. And that's fine. That's great. But then I say, where on this spectrum are the people saying, actually, in a whole load of places, let's not have farming. Let's actually see a reduction of the farmed area, concentrate in the areas where it makes good sense to farm because the productivity is good. But in areas where productivity is very low, let's not have farming. And it's, you're not going to get there just by saying, you know, let's change farm practice a little bit here. You know, you naturally need a change of policy. You need government to say, we're going to pay people not to farm here. We're going to pay people to rewild, to take down the fences, to introduce new species, to manage the land in a completely different way. And for that, you need a change of perspective. And what I'm trying to create here is a change of perspective.
How do you see your role, George? You've written previously that your role is to cause controversy in order to stimulate debate, which in turn leads to a consensus shifting towards something more progressive. Is that what you're trying to achieve?
That's part of it, to bring new information to light, to expose people to new ideas, to new research. Basically, to just try to change perspectives, to say the way we're looking at the world is not the only way to look at the world. There's completely different ways, taken from the completely different standpoint. So, you know, like I was saying about two people seeing the same piece of land in a completely different way, you know, you can see the situation in a completely different way. And I want to introduce some of those different ways.
So you're not actively trying to piss farmers off then? That's just an unintended consequence of your beliefs.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I know people are getting, I mean, it's not just farmers. I piss almost everybody off. Yeah, I mean, that's a byproduct. It's not the intention. It's just that is how it shakes out.
Mm. Are you hopeful for the future, George? And if you are, what makes you feel that way?
Yeah, I mean, I can see the potential. I can see how things could be turned around, you know, and rewilding is one of the things that gives me hope because, I mean, let's face it, environmentalism up to recently has been just about follow us and the world would be slightly less crap than it would otherwise have been. You know, it's a very defensive movement of just trying to stop bad things from happening. And to be able to say, follow us and we can have a much richer world for wildlife and for people, that to me is a far more inspiring vision. And rewilding is part of that positivity. But there's a whole lot of other aspects of positive environmentalism as well. Let's have much more livable cities. Let's have much better public transport systems, you know, whatever it might be. There's lots of ways in which you can say we can enhance our own lives while protecting our life support systems. Mm-hmm. I can see what could be done. And it's very frustrating seeing how many barriers to that there are. But one of the things which this pandemic has taught us, which has had terrible, terrible impacts on a lot of people, but it also shows us that when we need to change, we can change.
Yeah.
And, the changes we're calling for to prevent climate breakdown, to prevent ecological breakdown, to save ourselves from disaster are actually much smaller than the changes we've been asked to make in response to the pandemic. I mean, we're not talking about people staying in their own homes. We're just saying travel differently. We're not saying stop going to work, just work in different ways, you know. So if you can do it for the pandemic, we can do it for these much bigger disasters. I mean, we're facing the biggest predicament humanity has ever faced, which is the collapse of our life support systems. And we've just got to pull it out to respond to that. And so, when governments have been telling us all this while, there's only so much we can do, for instance, they'd be saying, there's no alternative to austerity. Governments can't borrow beyond a certain amount. Oh, the homeless, we would love them to be housed, but it's so sad, there's not enough space. Suddenly, as soon as the pandemic comes along, we could do that, and we could do that, and we could do that. So you were lying to us. When you said you couldn't do it, that was a lie, is you didn't want to do it. And so that does, in a way, give me hope that, the shift is there if we can just find the political will.
Okay, just to start to wrap things up, as an industry, we often say that we are part of the climate change solution. And I, as a farmer, I certainly go along with that. What do you think about that? What's your opinion?
Well, there's several ways of looking at it. I mean, first of all, obviously, we need food. And I think that food should be produced as effectively as possible to minimize the land area on which we produce it. And then you release land for carbon drawdown. Because basically all forms of agriculture, however, wherever they fit on the spectrum, involve a radical simplification of ecosystems. They have to if you're going to extract something from the end of it. You can't have these phenomenally complex food webs because there has to be a food web basically with the human being at the top of it, and this very simplified system where we're extracting a crop or a particular livestock species off the back of it. And so if you're going to store more carbon and create more diversity, that does mean less farmed area. That's the key change, the key shift. There's obviously some good things we can do with land sharing, but actually you can make a much bigger change by land sparing.
George, it's been fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I've really, really enjoyed talking to you. It's been absolutely fascinating. I did have about another 20, 30 questions to ask you, but unfortunately we've run out of time. But hopefully you might come again on the podcast sometime. But anyway, thank you very much for taking the time. It's been hugely, hugely appreciated.
Look, I really appreciate the opportunity. Always happy to talk. And it's great to be invited on. So thank you very much for that.
And to everyone at home, thanks for listening and hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.